Steve, welcome back to MidRats.
Hi, Sal and Eagle One. Thanks for having me back again. I'm looking forward to talking to you both about my second novel.
Well, Steve, it's really good to have you on here. We liked, we're both Eagle One and myself are kind of book geeks, so it's always good to have authors on, especially authors that are hitting on topics that the national security area, especially the maritime corner of it, is really going to find of interest. And I want to let those who may have read the book or those that are looking to buy the book, if you have some questions or observations after you've read, or just something you'd like for us to roll in our guests, I forgot to mention early on, go to the bottom of the show page if you're with us live, and you can join the chat room there, and Eagle One and I will be monitoring it, and you can go ahead and hop in there. If you have some questions, observations, we'll pull them out and fold them in as we go forward. But one thing I'd like to start off, Steve, is just for those that haven't read your second novel, The Recipient's Son, yet, if you could just outline the plot of it. We know it takes place in the Naval Academy in the 80s or the 90s, but what type of storyline are we looking at?
Yeah, you described it well by saying it's a coming-of-age story, which is very different from my first novel. Proximity is clearly an action novel. It's a, you know, the good guys going and kicking down doors and blowing stuff up. So this is a story about a young man at the Naval Academy in the early 90s, and he's a fictional classmate of my own, a member of the class of 1992, who has the unique and rare distinction of being the son of a posthumously awarded Medal of Honor recipient from the Vietnam War. And the notion is that if you're a son or daughter of a Medal of Honor recipient, you have automatic acceptance into any of the service academies. That's one of the benefits that is extended to those children. Not everybody is necessarily aware of that. And so his name is Donald Dorego, and Donald goes to the Naval Academy and sort of for the first time in his life has a shared experience with his father, albeit 20-some years later. And it is through his experience at the Naval Academy that he learns to identify with his who his father was and his father's naval service. And so it's as if he's finally able to connect to that identity through that shared experience. So what drives the plot is it starts on service selection night, which at that time, service selection is done differently now. When I was there, it was straight, basically service selection based on class rank. And you were literally called down on the 1MC. They'd get on and say, number 1 through 110, come on down. So it starts on service selection night, and then shortly after that, he's accused of harassment. So again, this is spring of his first class year. And he's kind of struggling with, oh my goodness, I could possibly get kicked out for this accusation. So then we get a flashback to his plebe year, and we see then the bulk of the novel is that, is him going through that identification with his father and learning to struggle through who his own identity is and the like. And then, of course, at the end, I bring you back to the modern day, and the story comes to its conclusion, which I won't give too much away. But as I laid all that out, what I also tried to do was very purposefully do a couple of things when I wrote the book. First, I wanted to describe the Naval Academy during my era because I think it was a unique time. You know, we came in 1988. It was a 600-plus ship Navy. It was the Cold War, and we always thought that if we ever were in combat, we'd be fighting the Russians. By the time we graduated, the Navy was downsizing, the Berlin Wall had fallen, and we had been to war during Desert Storm. And so I wanted to just sort of describe that through this storyline. Second, I wanted to present the different leadership styles through a variety of scenarios so that students and practitioners of naval leadership might sit back and discuss it. So there's very purposefully laid out different second class, I'd say, that the guy has to reflect on. So the different styles of his different upper class. Third, I wanted to make sure I shared some aspects of naval history and Naval Academy history. So again, I described the USS Summers affair, which was when Midshipman Philip Spencer mutinied on board a ship that ended up leading to midshipmen being trained for. And then or Colonel Ripley is another example. I discussed Colonel Ripley, Ripley at the Bridge. He was the Marine Corps captain at the time who blew up the Dong Ha Bridge and as a result prevented the North Vietnamese from invading South Vietnam in 1972. So I know that's a mouthful, but there's a lot of things that I purposely laced through this and put on the backs of this character, Donald DeRego, to relay to the audience so that they could, in a, both an entertaining and informative way, learn about the U.S. Naval Academy.
Well, it's a good book. Oddly enough, as I was reading the section on service selection, my younger son called me from his ROTC unit and had just been advised that he'd been selected for the program he's always wanted to go into. So the timing was impeccable as far as being able to read the book and understand what was going on in that. And let me note that I don't think I've really understood much about Naval Academy alumni, not being one myself, that I served with until I went through some of the aspects of your book. I'm obviously a little older than you are, but there are the aspects of the traditions at the Academy that have continued from generation to generation. A lot of the things like the message to Garcia and all that kind of stuff don't make much sense to people who come from ROTC units, but I can understand in the context of the Academy, and your book helped me do that much more about the Academy. How much of that was the intent of what you were writing to kind of go ahead.
Sure. Absolutely was part of the intent of what I wanted to do. Message to Garcia is a really good example. That is something that has been enduring, that has been at the Academy, long standing. And I did want to relay traditions and show both aspects. Clearly, there are parts of naval tradition and the U.S. Navy and the Naval Academy that change over time. If any graduate now who goes and returns can go and see that there are differences. But there are also clearly things that remain the same, and that is how the place gets part of its identity. And I definitely ensure that I put those aspects in as part of the foundation, because I knew that part of my audience would be Naval Academy alum who would enjoy the book and be tickled by reading things that they could recognize, even though the book is not set during their era or their time that they were there. But I also then wanted it to be read by young people who might be interested in going to the Academy to get a flavor of what it's like or what they will find if they go there. That was definitely also another very purposeful aspect of it. So I appreciate that you were able to pick up on it.
I thought another thing that I really enjoyed about the book is, and you brought up one of the things you use your characters as a way to describe different leadership styles, good leadership, bad leadership, a topic that we discussed last week with Claude Berube as well. And I think especially for that audience, it's a great venue to do that. And I'm sure you drew on people you've known, you built some composite characters. I thought you did a real good job with Commander Gordon. I won't give away too much, but you described him such that I physically could see the guy, and I know the type of leader you're exactly talking about there, because they are there. And one thing I wanted to ask is, as you go through, and especially something that is as close and personal as being a Naval Academy alumni that you are — I'm not, I'm a ROTC guy — to be able to draw into that and to build your characters without, creating a blueprint of somebody. As you build your characters and some of your classmates and others who went to the Academy have read it, have you had any of them come back at you and go, hey, is that supposed to be, person so-and-so? Or have tried to say, I wish you had added this extra because it reminds me of somebody else?
Right. I have had those conversations, and I was very forthright in ensuring that no single character could be connected to a person in real life. Clearly, there are some historical characters that are accurate. Heinz Lenz, for example, who used to lead the brigade in physical training, is mentioned in the book. Unfortunately, he has passed away. So that's a real person identified by his actual name. All of the characters that are fictional, like the various midshipmen, the company officers, even the superintendent and the commandant and the deputy dot, they are fictionalized characters. And I was very careful to make sure that there were aspects of them that were fictionalized such that they could not be connected. Although, I will readily admit that there were elements that I wanted to use, and so some of the characters on first glance might appear that they're actual. And I'll give a specific example. The company commander in 14th Company is Captain Oberly, Marine Corps Infantry Company officer. It just so happens my company officer was a Marine Infantry officer. But I wanted to make sure that Oberly, other than that, was not the same character, is not the same person, and it is not. And the reason was I wanted to reflect the notion that it is a common phenomena when you have a company officer of a particular field, and especially Marine Corps Infantry, they often have a positive influence on the midshipmen that are in their company, and then therefore will end up drawing many midshipmen to their career field. That ended up happening to me in my class. We had an inordinate number of Marines because of the positive leadership of my actual company officer. So save for that thread, I made sure that I put characteristics of him so it could not be confused with the real man. I then went to my company mates and had a couple of them act as editors for me and read, and purposefully with that eye to make sure that it didn't cross that boundary.
When you're writing a book, you went through the various communities in the Navy and the Marine Corps, and you picked up on some of the worst aspects of, I think, of every community except the aviation group. But how tempting is it to, or is it something you had to rein back in to go off on those eating their young or the characteristics of submarine community? Is that stop doing when you're writing a book like this?
Yeah, it is something that I want to do when I write, because I am sometimes frustrated by Hollywood perception created of anything, that everything is perfect and shiny and new and everything. I always want to depict any given community realistically, and therefore if you do that, often that means showing its flaws. Let me reflect back to proximity. Many people writing a book about the Navy EOD community, all the guys would be big, tall, handsome, and their hair is always perfect and the like. Whereas I very purposefully talked about the guys being in the boat and being seasick, and having to dive, and so showing their weakness and their flaws, and that they're getting seasick, in part because I suffered seasickness when I was a Navy diver. So for me, I recognized that I was identifying the flaws of some of those communities, the fact that the SWOs eat their young, the fact that the Submariner maybe is a guy who goes by a checklist and favors the guys that are in his community, because I want to reflect the truth. And if I was overzealous, then I would accept that as a criticism, but that's the perspective that I'm coming from, is I didn't want to write something that I think everybody knows from on the surface, excuse the pun, what a submarine officer's role is. So I wanted to definitely weave in the other aspects in Commander Gordon, or the notion from some of the surface warfare officers that are company officers that they eat their young, that their career is challenging and the like.
I think you were well inside the lifelines there. My father had a great phrase like, stereotypes exist because more than often than not, they're accurate. There is a broad brush there, but everything does have its own flavor. We all have our stories about going to dinner with the different personality types. But you mentioned early on how, part of the reasons that you wrote The Recipient Son was to help give some people a little more nuanced and background view of what things are like in the Naval Academy. Have you gotten some feedback, or have you heard from some young men and women who are in high school who are enlisted or looking at going to the Naval Academy, that may have read the book and had some questions for you? Have you received feedback from people at that end of the pipe? And if so, what have most of their questions and interests been about?
Yeah, I'm sorry, it's a short answer for that one. I have not heard from anyone in that realm yet, in part, I think, because the book is so new. It's just been about a month that it's been out. And so thus far, I think the folks who have found it by and large, are guys who are graduates or have some connection to the Naval Academy. So thus far, most of my feedback are from my peers or my near peers. But as, I'll tell you what, if ever I hear from youngsters that are reading it, that are interested in the community, I will give you guys some feedback on it. Maybe I can come back and we can talk about it at length.
Well, over in the chat room, I just saw Jerry Hendrick's 16-year-old daughter wants to read the book now, so maybe we'll have an early adopter that he can give you that perspective feedback. Eagle One, didn't mean to step on you. Go ahead.
Oh, that's all right. How long did you, I mean, when did you decide to write this book, and how long did it take you to put it together?
Yeah, that's a great question, and a classic one that an author gets about writing a book. I first started to write this book immediately when I was on Harlan County, shortly after I graduated from the Naval Academy and started my service as a junior officer. And it was one of these things that I spent a little bit of time on every now and again when I had a chance. Recently, a shipmate of mine, who was actually my state roommate on Harlan County for a while, said that to me. He said, I remember when you started writing this thing. So I will bet that in the sort of in the aggregate, maybe I had spent a year combined time up until about 2010 writing the first, say, 50,000 words of it. You know, first I sort of scoped out what the idea was, who the main character would be, what the themes I would want to come from the book, and then started writing it and wrote a good portion of it and laid out much of it. But then I felt like I wasn't ready for it to come out, and I was spurned on then by proximity, and when that book came to me, it came and I wrote that one, again, probably about the same time period. It took about 2 years, but really plowed through it and got that one out. And so then I came back to this one, and I approached the Naval Institute Press first with proximity and to see if they had an interest in it, and they passed on that. But then I presented them the idea of the recipient son. They liked it, and so in 2010, I really then had to scrub it out, add to it, build it up, shore it up, and bring it to its full fruition. So they got it in, it was in December of 2011. So all in all, it probably took me about 2 years to compile the whole thing and then get it to the press. And then naturally, we went through the editing process. I did some both with my peers, and then obviously did some with the press themselves.
I've been on active duty just I joined active duty just a few years before you did. So, you know, one thing that as a pup I saw take place was the whole post-tail hook fiasco and some of the political influence and a lot of things that we saw. And part of the book that you touch on is something that I didn't really appreciate until I'd been on active duty for a while, and I was talking to, you know, some of my shipmates who graduated from the academy. And my guess has always been it's just because Annapolis is so bloody close to D.C. But
right.
There is, for those that aren't aware of it or when they first come aware of it, a surprising amount of political influence and or interference, depending on how you would look at it, for the goings-on at the Naval Academy. Has that
right.
It's always been there, of course, and it's in the other service academies as well. But has that gotten worse, gotten better, or perhaps changed flavors over the years, if you want to use as a reference mark how you describe it in your book?
Sure. So first I'll say that it is true. The Naval Academy, I think, is always under the political spotlight because of its closeness to Washington, D.C. And that, my idea has been, and I'm sure many other midshipmen, former mids would say this, it's because a senator or congressman can very quickly get in a car and be down here and see and look at what's going on. I think in some ways the academy is also, of the service academies, the one that is most physically visible, right? It's right downtown Annapolis. People can relatively easily, you know, walk onto the campus. In comparison to West Point, I think is a little bit further away. You know, Air Force Academy, it's like 10 miles from the gate to where the main part of the campus is. So I think all of those things come together to make it a place that is much easier to be under the political spotlight. I think that it is true from my time all the way to now. And I live in the D.C. area. I've sponsored midshipmen. I hear the feedback from the brigade on these things. as it always is with those things, some of it is positive and some of it is negative. I was a midshipman during the tailhook times, and, you know, naturally it was something that we all talked about, and it was things that were brought up and challenged to us. And one of the themes, and I would say this is maybe even a third-level theme in the book. It's not something that I wanted to I wanted to use it as part of historical background, but my intention was not to, like, you know, grind any axes about tailhook or about political correctness or that. But I wanted to reflect that it, in fact, happened. And the main character himself reflects on and says, some of these changes that came about were positive, but as occurs in any of those political changes, sometimes the pendulum has swung too far, and there's some aspects of it that have gone too far. So I think that has been true. It was true in my day. I think it's still true today.
As you, this is a book about personal growth and about leadership, but the subtitle has to do with it being a tale of honor. You want to discuss the honor aspect of the book without giving the book away?
Sure. So there's, again, multiple layers. The first level of honor is sort of the main character is accused of harassment, and he is frustrated by that, as are the people around him. His mentor, Master Chief Strong, his very close friend and the JAG officer, Lieutenant Jan Meyer, because first they don't think that he's actually guilty of it, and they think that it's sort of a kangaroo court is emerging in this accusation of him that is laced with politics, because the midshipman who he's accused of harassing, she is politically connected. And so there's sort of this notion of, so at what point do we respect and honor the honor code, the honor system? And he's not accused of an honor code, but there's this notion of, you know, what is the honorable thing to do? What's the honorable way to proceed? What is the honorable way to go about this? And that there's this notion of the system is being used against him and politics are being used against him and other midshipmen. He's not the only one that's accused. And so that is struggling with sort of his honor. This is the next layer down, that he feels towards the legacy of serving his father, to the point where he comes to a very interesting inner conflict of, he sort of, they say, so use your dad's honor as a trump card to get out of this. If you fight politics with politics, in effect, you should call attention to the fact that you're the son of a Medal of Honor recipient, and in effect, because of the politics of this place, your charges will be dropped, it'll be swept under the carpet and the like. And he struggles with that and sort of says, if that's the way I'm going to get through this, I'm not sure I want to belong to this system. I don't know that I want to serve in this Navy. Maybe I do want to be kicked out. So I can share that without completely ruining the story and say that it's part of the character's aspect of him struggling with his identity of his father and what it means and what he's going to use that identity for. So that, I think, is where the subtitle comes from.
We talked a little bit about before, you know, waiting to get the feedback from the youngsters, so to speak, who might be interested in the Naval Academy. But as somebody who obviously has written something very personal, you know, looking back at the time you were there, and of course there is that very personal attachment to the Naval Academy. But there are also some other authors out there that have written about the Naval Academy, either their experiences or it in general. Are there some other books out there that young men and women who might be thinking about going to the Naval Academy or the service academies that you would recommend to them in hindsight that they should get hold of and read and absorb to help inform their decision?
Absolutely. And both of them are mentioned in different forms in my book. The first one is A Sense of Honor by James Webb. I mentioned several of Senator Webb's books in my own. I was influenced as a young person by reading his book, A Sense of Honor, which takes place he was a class of 68, so it takes place during that time period. I think it's a fantastic book, and I really enjoyed it. And it's one that every now and again I enjoy pulling off the shelf and reading. Another one is by David Poyer, who is the class of 1971, and it's called The Return of Philo T. McGiffen. Similar time frame. Captain Poyer was class of 71, so again, it kind of takes place around that same time period, a little bit later than A Sense of Honor, but both are really great books. I was honored that David Poyer read the, read this manuscript, and he gave me a nice quote for the jacket, and I was very appreciative. To me, that was a nice victory to have accolades from him. Those are the only two that I can think of off the top of my head, because those, I think, are the two classic novels that folks want to look at about the Naval Academy. I hope, naturally, that someday my novel, The Recipient's Son, is mentioned in the same breath with those two.
Well, if I have the chance to discuss people who want to go to the Naval Academy books, your book will certainly be on the list that I give them. As we wind down our time with you, Steve, what have you got in your hopper next, and what can we look forward to?
Sure. I mentioned last time when I did Proximity, I have two other books in the work that are in the EOD realm. One, I think, is going to become sort of a lifelong project. It's a grind to do it, and it's very important to do it right, and that is Improvise, EOD Techs in the War on Terrorism. And through that book, what I've been doing is interviewing EOD techs about their experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan. I think some of it's going to expand now into other aspects of the war on terrorism, and I intend for it to come out as a nonfiction account of what those guys are doing. Each story that I hear is more amazing than the next. Just the heroism of the young EOD technicians of all services, unbelievable. So, but hold on to that one. I think the one that will actually emerge first will be my sequel to Proximity. It has a working title of Pressure Release. We're going to see Jazz Jasinski again. We're going to see the FBI agent Elena Cruz again. Some of the other favorite characters will return. Grover Dank's going to come back, and the mysterious Tracy's going to return. That one is fairly mature, and I hope that we see that one within the next few years.
Well, that's great. We look forward to seeing those things. And let me again tell the people who are listening in that this is a really good book, and you ought to take a chance of, when you get the chance, go pick it up.
Thank you.
Absolutely agree. And Steve, I really appreciate you coming on this afternoon. It's been a really quick 30 minutes, and I look forward to reading what you have coming down the road.
Great. Can I add one or two more things?
Absolutely.
I hope folks will follow me. It's the social media age, right? I'm on Twitter. I'm at EOD author on Twitter. You can follow me on Facebook. It's www.facebook.com/author Stephen Phillips. And if you go on Facebook and look at the title of both of my books, The Recipient's Son and Proximity, there's a page for each one of those if you like those in particular.
Perfect. And I look forward to seeing the rest of the rollout with the book, because you're still early on. You should have a real busy fall. And best of luck to you, Steve.
Thank you very much, and thank you again for having me on Midrats.
Okay, thanks for coming on. We enjoyed it.